You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the 2023 U.S. Championship Cheese Contest wrapped up last week. We'll talk to the creator behind the aged Gouda that took first prize. Now, a train that derailed in East Palestine, Ohio earlier this month included 20 cars carrying hazardous materials. 10 of those cars came off the rails, 5 of which were carrying a chemical compound called vinyl chloride. It's a gas that's used to make a variety of plastics. It's harmful, though, when humans ingest significant amounts of it. The EPA and the railroad operator released the derailed vinyl chloride in a controlled burn to try and mitigate the risk to humans and other wildlife in the area. But the presence of the toxic chemicals created fear for the surrounding community and conservationists around the country. We're learning more now about what vinyl chloride actually is and what it's used for. Alex Jordan is Assistant Professor of Plastics Engineering in the Engineering Technology Department at UW-Stout. Alex, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you tell us a little bit about, for those of us without a chemistry degree, what vinyl chloride is?
So vinyl chloride is the monomer that's used primarily to make the polymer or plastic polyvinyl chloride, PVC, which is recycling symbol number 3. It's largely, the vinyl chloride is largely derived from petroleum-based feedstocks, where we can convert low molecular weight gases, like ethane into ethylene, and crack that down and further convert that to become the vinyl chloride monomer.
And then you mentioned this is PVC. I think we've all encountered PVC pipes. There's a lot of products. I'm guessing this is an incredibly a common product if it's the VC in PVC.
Correct. And due to the nature of the VC monomer itself, it's largely used mostly entirely to manufacture PVC. So the demand for vinyl chloride largely follows the demand for PVC, which is linked to construction.
And then what form does vinyl chloride travel in, a liquid or a gas?
It's typically transported as a gas. It's usually transported or handled in a double wall container where it's stored inside one container. And then between the first and second container, there's an inert gas like nitrogen. So if there is a small leak in the inner container, there's a detector that can detect that leak as when the VC gas mixes with the nitrogen gas. And it'll trigger a safety shutoff where that goes to a like a residual underground storage facility. Now, when you're transporting it, you obviously don't have that residual facility, but OSHA and EPA regulations for handling the material are fairly stringent. So you have a lot of protection there.
And what is it about vinyl chloride that makes us want to be so careful with it?
It's a flammability risk, particularly in the presence of oxygen. It's also a known carcinogen. Actually, prior the early 70s and before, it was actually used as the aerosol propellant for various products. And then once we kind of realized that it's a carcinogen, it was removed from those applications.
And maybe a dumb question here, if we want to use PVC for various plastic purposes, do we have to have this vinyl chloride to make it, or are there workarounds?
Currently, there are no commercially available or sustainable workarounds. So we really do use vinyl chloride monomer almost exclusively to make PVC. Typically, vinyl chloride monomer is refined from crude oil, and it's largely converted and polymerized into PVC at a site very close to, even sometimes in the same facility, that the VC monomer is actually created. And then once it's polymerized, we add stabilizers to it so that we can use it out in the environment. But even without the stabilizers, once it's converted into plastic pellet, it's very, very safe and stable.
Oh, that's interesting. So I'm hearing you say usually if we're making vinyl chloride gas, we're using it on site to make something like PVC. But in this case, it was being transported. Do you have a sense of how much vinyl chloride is transported from site to site as opposed to used where it's made?
I don't actually have that in front of me.
That's fine. I was just popped into my head there. Now, when we talk about the toxicity of vinyl chloride, how does it compare to other chemicals that might be used in the plastic process?
It would be slightly more carcinogenic. There's a wide range of chemicals that are actually used to manufacture plastics. All plastics are derived from various monomers. For instance, polyethylene is derived from the ethylene monomer. Things like polystyrene are derived from the styrene monomer. You can have PET, recycling symbol 1, that's polyethylene terephthalate, comes from terephthalic acid and ethylene glycol. They all have some safety issues, but typically we will have those monomers with an inhibitor and a stabilizer for safety as well as for protecting their reactivity so they don't form a polymer prematurely where we can't use it.
And I got to ask, Alex, before I let you go, whether it's people you know or your students or other media, is this accident in Ohio getting a lot of people interested in asking their local plastics engineering professor what this stuff is?
I've gotten quite a few questions. I know some of my colleagues have as well. A lot of people asking what we can use as a substitute for polyvinyl chloride, the polymer that comes from it. You can imagine that as demand for polyvinyl chloride would decrease if it could be replaced with other plastics or plastic composites, the demand for production and transport of vinyl chloride monomer would subsequently decrease.
And is there something that people are looking at as a substitute product for PVC?
Right now, the the abrasion resistance and the chemical stability really make PVC ideal for like siding and piping applications. But there are people using things like cross-linked polyethylene, PEX, PEX tubing, and the competitive like PVC can be used for food-grade packaging. It's actually that safe. But you can also use things like polystyrene and PET. So as we learn more about the material science of various plastics, you may see some plastics come more into demand, and other plastics that have traditionally dominated certain markets may start to fall off in favor of other plastics.
Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Alex Jordan, Assistant Professor of Plastics Engineering at UW-Stout, with us to tell us a little more about how manufacturers make and use vinyl chloride, one of the toxic chemicals released in the train derailment earlier this month in East Palestine, Ohio. Coming up, the maker of the country's best cheese of the year joins us to share the story of his champion Gouda and the Wisconsin influences behind it. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the new U.S. champion cheesemaker joins us to talk about his winning Gouda and learning his craft here in Wisconsin. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an answer to an audience question about some mysterious trains.
Just off a highway in northwest Wisconsin's Washburn County sits a long string of parked rail cars of different shapes and sizes. A listener who regularly passes these rail cars was curious about them. So she reached out to Wisconsin to figure out why they are there. WPR's Andrea Anderson took a road trip to find the answer.
If you're driving north along Highway 53 between Spooner and Trigo, you'll see a long line of rail cars parked on tracks on your right. The line of different cars seems like it will never end. Mary Kay Lovejoy passes these rail cars on the way to her cabin in Bayfield County, and she's always wondered why they're parked here.
You know, I always wondered, do these move? Are they just here in storage? And then I got curious, well, are they related to the frac sand mining? Why are they there all the time?
The question led me to Greg Vreeland. He is the general manager of the Wisconsin Great Northern Railroad, a company that operates on the tracks where the mysterious rail cars are parked. Vreeland says a couple things determine if a rail car is moving from place to place: the global economy and what commodities are in demand.
At various points of the year, railroad cars of specific types become surplus to the needs of the shipping community. When there are extra cars that need a place to park, the railroads and the owners of the cars work with the small, what they call short line railroads, to use extra pieces of track that are not being used for another purpose to store the cars on.
Vreeland leases 26 miles of tracks from the state of Wisconsin and Canadian National Railway. Some of the rail is used for scenic train rides his business runs. But the rail cars Lovejoy was curious about, those are parked on another portion of these leased tracks. Vreeland says there are close to 500 rail cars from companies around the world parked on a 6-mile portion of track. Most haul frac sand and have been sitting here for 1 to 3 years.
The frac sand market is currently depressed, so there's not the need for the number of cars that there was a few years ago. So consequently, there are a few hundred frac sand cars currently parked.
So to be honest, I'm a lot like Lovejoy. I've seen rail cars parked here many times as I travel to family cabins up north. And I've always wondered why they sit here. The tracks run nearly right alongside the highway, and the vehicle traffic is loud. Vreeland met me here to check out the line of rail cars. It looks even longer up close, and the cars are huge. Some have graffiti and look weathered, others appear new. And as he points out, some rail cars are round and others look like a rectangle.
The small cars, the short cars, are frac sand cars.
Regardless of what shape they take, rail cars are expensive to build. Their lifespan lasts decades. When they aren't being used, they're parked because it's more economical to store them until they're needed rather than scrap them. And companies try to place rail cars close to where they will be used. But finding storage can be difficult.
There are various times when a lot of cars need to be stored, you know, when we have a recession or a downturn. Unfortunately, storage becomes very, very short supply, and then cars, wherever they can find a place, they get stuck.
The economy also drives how often a rail car is pulled from the string. Vreeland's staff could do it a few times a year or a few times a week.
Frac sand could be really big 2 months from now. You just never know. And if that happens, the phone will just ring off the hook. It's like, we need our cars back.
For now, the rail cars will sit here, waiting for the day they're needed to move goods from one place to another.
WPR's Andrea Anderson brought us that story on the sitting rail cars in Spooner. And that story idea came from a listener as part of our Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, most Wisconsinites know their way around a good cheese. You might have even had a cheese at some point that you say is the best in the nation. It's from Wisconsin, after all. But there actually is a best cheese in the United States, as decided by the U.S. Championship Cheese Contest last week in Green Bay. The winner was an aged Gouda called Europa. It didn't come from a farm in Wisconsin. The crown went to Arethusa Farm Dairy in Bantam, Connecticut. But don't worry, it's got strong Wisconsin ties. Eric Schmidt is the head cheesemaker at Arethusa Farm Dairy. He grew up in Monticello and worked for Wisconsin cheese producers for nearly a decade before moving to Connecticut last year. Eric, congratulations and welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on today.
Now tell us about Europa. What ended up making it the best cheese in the country?
Well, you know, all great cheese starts with great milk, and you really got to give it out, you know, give props to the dairy farmers in Litchfield County, Connecticut. They have great farming practices. They got really good herd management, and, you know, you can't beat a grass-fed milk out here, so.
Yeah, I wonder about that because I think, the journey from milk to cheese, like a lot happens along the way. But that initial milk quality really does pay off in the end, Eric?
Oh, 100%. It makes, you know, milk quality is always number one. You can't, you know, just like, you know, with anything, like if you're making bread, if you're starting off with bad flour, you're not going to have a great, a bad sourdough starter. You know, if you don't have the flavor there, if you don't have the good quality ingredient, you're not going to get a good quality product. So, you know, tip of the hat to Connecticut farmers on that one, and especially Arethusa Farm Dairy with their farming practices.
And I understand you'd entered this Europa and aged Gouda in earlier contest. Didn't do as well. And I guess part of the story was it hadn't aged quite enough.
Well, that's not true, actually.
Oh, okay.
So this Europa has taken multiple best of classes. There's a cheese contest in the New England area called the Big E, which is like kind of like their big, like, you know, Wisconsin State Fair is the big fair. They kind of put it all together out here, and it's called the Big E. Yeah, it's up in Massachusetts. This cheese actually took best of show at the Big E also.
Okay.
What I was referring to is I put in not only in the age Gouda category, but I put it in the Edamame Gouda category, and we didn't take top honors in the, you know, 1, 2, 3 for, you know, best of class. You know, we weren't in the top three. We got like 7th or 8th, I believe. And then the extra aged is what won the whole competition.
Gotcha. I see. Now you are in Connecticut now, but we shouldn't feel too bad in Wisconsin, because as I mentioned, you've got a pretty strong Wisconsin connection. Can you tell us about your upbringing when it comes to making cheese here in the state?
Yeah. I mean, I was out of high school for almost a year. I needed a job. I was kind of doing the job bouncing thing. I was pretty aimless. And the first cheese factory I worked at was Chula Vista Cheese outside of Browntown, Wisconsin. That's really the starting point, you know, when I got into the commodity side of things. And the whole process really, really interested me. You know, fermentation has always been, you know, I don't know if I can say this, but when I was 19, I was actually making mead at home, you know.
As long as you weren't drinking it, it's fine.
No, I wasn't. but, you know, fermentation always had it was a surprising science to me, just because there's naturally occurring things in the environment we as humans harnessed. These things either on purpose or by accident, you know, it's just an amazing thing. And, you know, what really got me, brought me to the artisan side of things was I actually took a job when I was 23. I moved out to the state of Oregon and worked out on the coast, and I milked cows into the vat and made cheese. You know, I milked the cow, right? And, you know, I did the whole thing. So that really gave me the appreciation for artisan cheese. And I do want to say, you know, this is not only, you know, it's a huge win for the state of Connecticut, for dairymen across Connecticut, but it's also a huge win for artisan cheese, because this is, you know, it's handmade. It's hand flipped. There's no robots here. It is people coming in every day taking care of this cheese in a cellar. So it is a huge win.
Can you talk about what makes someone a good cheesemaker? It seems like it would take a lot of patience and attention to detail, both things I'm really bad at. What else makes someone, you know, a cheesemaker?
Well, patience, attention to detail, and, you know, it's just, you have to have the will to keep learning, because, you know, you can talk to any master cheesemaker, you can talk to any cheesemaker across the country. You never stop learning, because there's always some gremlin that pops up a new problem, you know, and that's what really, you know, has kept me going, is that problem solving aspect with cheese. There's always something to solve.
I want to bring things back to the award winning Gouda now. Can you talk about its, you know, the history of this kind of cheese? What kind of tradition you were tying into here with Europa?
Dutch Gouda. It is a traditional Dutch Gouda recipe. And it's, you know, when I first started here, aged Gouda has always been one of my favorite cheeses, you know, just the way it's sweet, it's caramely, it's roasty. Then you have tyrosine development. Tyrosine development only occurs on a well-aged and well-made piece of cheese. And it had all that, and it quickly became one of my favorite cheeses here. And it's traditional, you know, we're cooking with water, you know, it's a wash curd style cheese. So we actually, instead of like using our steam jacket, we're actually removing whey, which is, you're doing two different things. So you're removing part of the food, which is lactose, that's in the whey. And then you're adding water, which is sweetening up that curd. And then you're actually providing a heat source for you to kickstart that lactic acid to produce, or lactic acid bacteria to start, you know, start fermenting.
And Eric, just very briefly, you've conquered aged Gouda now. Do you have an aspirational cheese? Like, I want to make that kind of cheese next.
Yeah, of course. I've been partial to cloth-bound cheddars. I know everyone kind of has a cloth-bound cheddar nowadays. One of the top 20s were up at the U.S. Championship this year was made by Redhead Creamery in Minnesota, and they have a great cloth-bound cheddar. That's one that's in my sights. We currently do not make a cloth-bound cheddar. We make a cheddar, but we actually just butter it, and it's a natural rinded cheddar. But that would probably be the next cheese. Excellent. In my sights to kind of perfecting, because this Europa was such a great recipe to start with.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Eric Schmid, head cheesemaker at Arethusa Farm Dairy in Bantam, Connecticut, winner of the 2023 U.S. Championship Cheese Contest held here in Wisconsin. Sounds like some good cheese. I'm hungry for some aged Gouda. I'll eat that coming up on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. Then new data from the CDC shows record high levels of sadness, violence, and risk of suicide for teenage girls. We'll talk with a children's health expert here in Wisconsin about what's behind those numbers, what we can do to turn things around. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Wisconsin travel writer shares some of her must-do activities around the state, and you could share some of yours. First, according to new data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there are record high levels of sadness, violence, and risk of suicide for teenage girls. According to the CDC, nearly 6 in 10 teen girls felt persistently sad or hopeless in 2021, twice the rate of boys. Almost 2 in 10 experienced sexual violence, and 3 in 10 seriously considered attempting suicide at some point. Our next guest says Wisconsin is seeing similar trends, and healthcare systems are adapting to try to meet the mental and emotional health needs of adolescent girls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something you're seeing in your own community, your own family? What do you think some of the reasons for these trends might be? What questions do you have our guest? What solutions do you see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Allie Hurst is medical director of the Pediatric Emergency Department at UW Health Kids and assistant professor of pediatric emergency medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Hurst, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks much for having me.
Now, these new numbers came out from CDC with our most recent data year, 2021. I understand you've already been seeing similar concerns in your work as a pediatric emergency specialist. What are you seeing?
So it's pretty shocking the number of children now presenting with not only suicidal ideation, but attempts, and just mental health crises overall in general are increasing. We, as an emergency department, have seen the most shocking and the most evident change and increase in visits in the 0 to 13-year-old group, like 0 years old to 13 years old, which a lot of people I don't think consider, especially based on the fact that as kids get older, between the 14 and 17-year-old group, that's usually when you're starting to see adolescent rebellion and things that can cause them to be more reactive and more upset. But our increases are showing that younger and younger children are having more of these crises. And in fact, from 2020 to 2022, our numbers of 0 to 13-year-old patients increased by 77% for mental health crises alone. And many of those had needed just outpatient treatment or received just outpatient treatment, while about 34% of those received inpatient psychiatric treatment for their complaints.
Looking at those CDC numbers, we see an increase in the pandemic years, but also a steady increase in these concerns and these numbers leading up to 2020. You just mentioned 2020 to 22, right smack in pandemic years. Do you see this as a problem that was on the rise even pre-COVID?
Absolutely. And especially the fact that we are desperate for outpatient mental health resources and were before the pandemic. Now this massive increase has truly put a strain on our system, not only from a pediatric emergency department perspective, but also outpatient psychiatrists. They can't keep up with the amount of demand that there is for their subspecialty. And so a lot of the overflow of patients who can't get care outpatient end up in the emergency department, which unfortunately or fortunately is not the best place for mental health treatment, especially if it's not an emergency. If it's not true suicidal ideation with a plan, sometimes we aren't able to deliver the perfect care, psychiatric care for children. We do our best. We are absolutely the place. If you don't know what else to do, we are absolutely the place to go to. But we're really struggling in terms of getting these kids the care they need. And absolutely, it started before the pandemic. It's just been exponentially exacerbated by the fact that we were completely isolated during the pandemic itself.
One thing I wonder, is there maybe some good news here that maybe a problem that might have been ignored or not taken as seriously in the past, or there was concern about stigma? Now maybe people are taking this more seriously and seeking care when they wouldn't have before. I'm digging for the slightest of silver linings here. Is there any sign that that might be the case?
That's a really interesting question, actually, because part of the problem we think is actually social media. But at the same time, a lot of kids actually reach out when they are having mental health problems on their social media. I've had a lot of kids brought to the emergency department by 911 because their friends saw them overdosing on pills or trying to commit suicide online, and then they got help they needed. So it's a double-edged sword in that social media is incredibly isolating. But at the same time, I agree with you. I do think it's actually caused a lot more people to be open about it. Whether or not they intended to be in some of those cases, it's definitely gotten some kids the help that they needed when, you're right, there wasn't a way for us to find out beforehand.
We're talking to Dr. Allie Hurst, Medical Director of the Pediatric Emergency Department at UW Health Kids, looking at rises in concern about a mental and emotional well-being and health for teen girls, as she mentioned, preteen girls as well. She has seen this in her own department. New CDC numbers also confirm it. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. If this has been a concern in your family and you're willing to talk about it, we would love to hear from you. If you found ways to help, love to hear that too at 800-642-1234. Dr. Hurst, let's talk about some of the possible reasons behind this. And let's start with social media. You mentioned that as a possible at least contributing factor here. What are you seeing?
So a lot of the information that we're gathering is from teenagers that often don't want to talk about it to us directly. So it can be really difficult to discern whether or not where the exact pressures are coming from. The Washington Post article that came out last month was very interesting in pointing out that a lot of the beauty expectations of young girls especially is not within realm of anyone attaining. And it's interesting also because social media, the algorithm that's made to create it to be addictive, actually focuses then on the same type of content. So if you look at one picture or one video of somebody that's thin and has everything that they ever want in life, it is going to continue to show you the exact same thing, but more of it with different people. And so I think that in and of itself has been isolating for girls who there's an impossible beauty standard to achieve. And then the social media networks and the way that they're designed show you more of that. And so I think it's caused a lot of girls to feel desperate and that they can't attain any of these things, that it's social media's reinforcing that they should. So I think not only is that part of it, but they're also mimicking their parents because all parents are all on social media as well. And kids are like a sponge. As soon as they see someone that is a role model for them or one of their parents doing something, then they are also going to want to participate in it. Even young kids, like very young kids and toddlers, know how to use smartphones better than some adults do, just because they're exposed to it constantly. So not only is it a modality that every child is now interacting with, but then it's also creating these divergent ideas of what true life is actually like based on what kids are seeing.
Are you hoping that parents approach social media in a particular way, whether that's a limiting or setting, you know, deadlines or saying not until age, whatever, or just having conversations with their girls in particular about social media?
I think everyone needs to have the conversation for sure. That's definitely something that, you know, when you're talking about the birds and the bees with your kids, that you should approach social media as well. A lot of sexual, not as particularly violence, but sexual abuse is actually happening online now. So even, you know, back in the 90s, when it was still like chat rooms, you had to be very careful on AOL chat rooms. It's the same today, but with every type of social media. Boys and girls are sending pictures to each other, whether it's solicited or not. And that's abusive. That is not helpful to anybody, and it makes people feel very uncomfortable. So having that discussion about safety on social media, limiting social media, and then mimicking that, doing what you want your child to do by limiting their own social media use, I think is the next step forward.
We're talking to Dr. Allie Hurst, Medical Director of the Pediatric Emergency Department at UW Health Kids. We're talking about the well-being of teen girls and an increase, according to CDC numbers, in rates of things like sadness and suicidal thoughts. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something you're seeing in your school, your community, or your family? What do you think might be some of the reasons behind these challenges for teen girls and preteen girls as well? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you talk about social media with your kids? Have you had that conversation? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Dr. Allie Hurst, Medical Director of the Pediatric Emergency Department at UW Health Kids. Talk about the emotional, mental, and physical well-being of teen girls. UW Health Kids reports a dramatic increase in mental health-related visits to their emergency department over the past decade. There's been a significant jump there since 2020, and new CDC data shows girls in greater danger than boys across almost all mental health measures and increasing concerns among all those measures. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions for our guest. Let's bring on a caller now. Andrea is with us in Southwest Wisconsin. Andrea, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Andrea?
Well, when I was 13, I had a girlfriend spending the night, and just out of the blue, I said to her, I can't handle this anymore. I just can't handle it. And I swallowed a whole bottle of baby aspirin. And I thought that meant I was going to die, and I wanted to. So she called the emergency room, and they just laughed and told her to, you know, to put me to bed. She never told my parents. The hospital never followed through with it. And that's the only drugs I knew that were in the house.
Andrea, thank you so much for calling. I'm glad you're still with us. Can I ask Andrea about how long ago was this?
Well, 50 years ago.
Okay. Thank you again. I'm glad you're with us to share that unfortunate story. First of all, Dr. Hurst, I'm hoping an emergency room would react very differently than Andrea described there today.
I agree. I'm really sorry you went through that, Andrea. That sounds terrible.
And apart from, you know, the physical concerns there, what kind of treatment would an emergency room offer someone who had made that apparent suicide attempt that Andrea describes 50 years ago? What should an emergency room be doing in that instance?
So initially, we would check for medical stabilization. That is our first and foremost job, in fact, for anyone presenting to our emergency department. We would check labs. We would check the level of salicylate. So the active metabolite in aspirin that we look for are the salicylate levels. They can affect the kidneys very seriously. And then usually if the levels are high enough to create a toxicity in the body, we start a special mixture of fluids that helps to process the metabolite more quickly and to protect the kidneys. And usually it does mean an admission to the hospital at least overnight while making sure that the kidneys are still healthy and safe and that the metabolite clears.
And then apart from the physical well-being at that point, this is obviously a mental health concern. What would be the next steps there?
So in this day and age, we would consult our psychiatry team. We have a children's specific psychiatry team that would come talk to the patient and make sure that they do have all the safety requirements in place, or not even requirements, but if the patient does need admission based on the fact that they are having an active suicidal plan, then to probably admit them to a psychiatric facility in order to help them work through these thoughts and get them the care, the expeditious care that they need.
And finally, Andrea had mentioned, you know, this sensation that, in effect, the world was too much, and that's what led her to do this. Is this, I guess, a common story of people who, especially young girls who show up in emergency rooms?
I do think so, especially with the idea that there's nothing that they can do to change the trajectory of their lives, which, as, of course, adults know, having been through it, you can change the trajectory of your life. You can get help. It just doesn't feel like that, though, as an isolated teenager. And even 50 years ago, when Andrea was having these thoughts, things like that can feel so just uniquely an experience that you are going through yourself and nobody else. And so it can be very difficult to see to the future, especially when you don't think that there's anything that can help you.
Thanks again for sharing that story. Brian joins us now in Madison. Brian, hello.
Hi, I just had a question in regards to social media aspect that was brought up. I know you spoke about like beauty standards. I was wondering more on sort of the social justice side of things, not just major events like, you know, George Floyd or these recent earthquakes, but just how much more interconnected we are with seeing the real like miserable conditions that some people are forced to live with. That feels overwhelming to me. So I was just wondering if you're seeing that reflected in this younger cohort.
Brian, interesting question. Thanks for the call. Dr. Hurst, people's exposure to the bad things in the world.
You know, that is really interesting to think about, because we do know minute to minute, second to second, what else is happening everywhere else. I haven't actually thought about that in terms of what our teenagers are seeing and how that might affect them. But I absolutely think you're right that seeing not only these impossible beauty standards, but then these overwhelmingly sad and horrific events happening in the rest of the world can also contribute to poor mental health and feeling like there isn't anything better that might happen in your lives or other people's lives. So I don't have any data to support that, but I do absolutely think that that's probably contributing as well.
Thanks for the call, Brian. And Brian's point takes us to something else from this CDC report in terms of who is particularly vulnerable. And the CDC data talks about, for example, LGBTQ teens and their risks of mental health concerns. Is that something you are seeing in your practice?
Absolutely. Not only the LGBTQIA plus community, but also communities of color are being affected much more than white communities or other ethnicities and race. So it is something that we are actively trying to not only improve their well-being and improve how they're accepted in our community, but also to let them know we are there for them and that we do not want them to feel as isolated as they might feel, not only because of their communities or their schools or even on social media.
Thanks again for that call, Brian. We are talking to Dr. Allie Hurst with UW Health Kids, medical director there of the Pediatric Emergency Department, looking at mental health challenges, emotional challenges facing teen and preteen girls. CDC data shows things getting worse. Dr. Hurst's emergency room also seeing that. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. We've talked, Dr. Hurst, about social media, about inequality in some ways. Are there other things you are looking at as possible causes of concern leading to these problems here, at least that you might want to see investigated more?
Well, especially the sexual violence and abuse that is happening in young girls as well. One of the things that I think is well underrepresented is actually how much online presence sexual violence has. And it does often then translate into in-person sexual violence that young teens are seeing. And I don't want to say it's just limited to teen girls. It's happening to young men as well. And those of the trans population. So it's something that I think needs a lot more, not only research into it, but also to report it more frequently. Something called sexploitation, which happens online, is basically blackmailing for sexual photos or videos. It's happening to many teens all over the place. It's way more common than people think. And being able to at least identify it, do research on it, and report it because it is a crime is something that we need to focus on a little bit better as well.
And I also want to focus for a bit on resources for that young girl after that emergency room visit. Dr. Hurst, you mentioned the resources aren't always there. What do we need to see around Wisconsin so that you can confidently send that patient on to get treatment they might need?
Absolutely. There are a lot of different facilities that are not only expanding their coverage in order to help these teenagers, but it's now been declared a national emergency in child and adolescent mental health. The entire country is on board with this now, realizing how big of an issue it is. Part of the things that we're trying to do to improve our resources and improve our outpatient reach is to not only decompress our inpatient facilities, so not only our psychiatric facilities, but even our pediatric hospital, we're trying to decompress those in order to be able to accommodate for those that are presenting with true suicidal ideation and plans or true suicide attempts. We're also trying to recruit more people into child and adolescent psychiatry and outpatient therapy in order to help strengthen not only our outpatient referral network, but also to allow for the huge upsurge of patients to get the care that they need.
Right. What kind of care, what kind of resources would you like to see out there, to prevent those emergency rooms visits in the first place, to get some help to people before they're in that acute crisis situation?
Well, I know a lot of schools are actually currently trying to connect a lot more mental health resources within the school itself, which I think would be incredibly helpful with the fact that everyone is back in person learning. You can identify suicidal ideation and risk much better when you're in person. And so identifying those kids when they are at school and then being able to get them either the expedited help they need through the emergency department or to be able to refer them outpatient, I think would be helpful. But especially what I want to see coming in the future and in the near future, especially, is to recruit more people that will do this type of care and will take care of these children so that they can reach out to them and not have to use the emergency department as their backup system.
Time for one more caller. Sarah is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hi, thank you so much. So I don't have kids, but I've been a long-term sub with different ages, substitute teacher. And I've taught second grade and seventh grade, and both of those classes had trouble. The girls especially were very upset about animal torture videos that they found online.
Oh, goodness. Sarah, you're breaking up a little, but I got the gist, Sarah. A teacher, if you didn't hear that part, Dr. Hurst, saying her students are seeing very disturbing videos online. Animal torture, I think she said. Dr. Hurst, again, a reminder for parents to help their kids and, help keep them away from disturbing stuff.
Absolutely. And it's horrifying to know and be able to even see what is available online to watch. Part of the reason that we think sexual violence is increasing is also due to the accessibility of like pornographic websites to children. And so knowing that not only are there locks on their phones that you can create in order to prevent them from visiting sites like that and watching YouTube videos of that nature, but also to consider when is the right time to buy a smartphone for your child, whether or not they are mature enough to be able to process something and be able to know that that's not the right thing to do, and it can be really difficult to navigate. And something I would talk to your pediatrician or your family doctor about, in fact. There's more and more research coming out about when the right time might be for teenagers, not only based on family preferences, but also when your child is mature enough.
Dr. Hurst, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Allie Hurst is Medical Director of the Pediatric Emergency Department at UW Health Kids and Assistant Professor of Pediatric Emergency Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She joined us for a look at the ways we can help improve the mental well-being of adolescent girls. You can always contact the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. If you're experiencing mental health-related distress or worried about a loved one who may need crisis support, you can call or text 988 to connect with a trained crisis counselor. 988 is confidential, free, and always available. Coming up after the news, if you think you've experienced all the must-dos around Wisconsin, our guest shares ideas from her new book of great things to do around the state, and you can add your suggestions as well. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.